to spend a night in the same town or nearby villages. After dark, when most people had gone to bed, they would rendezvous. If she was staying in a tavern, Ned would creep into her room. On warm nights, they sometimes met in woods. The secrecy made their meetings almost unbearably thrilling. Right now, he was only a few miles from Newcastle, and she was hoping to slip away on some pretext and see him today. She lived in a state of continuous excitement that made it almost impossible for her to eat. She lived on wheat bread with butter and watered wine. Bart seemed oblivious. It would never have occurred to him that his wife might be unfaithful, any more than he would have expected his own dog to bite him. Marjorie's mother, Lady Jane, probably had her suspicions, but would not say anything for fear of causing trouble. However, Marjorie knew she and Ned could not get away with this behavior indefinitely. It might take a week or a year, but sooner or later they would be found out. Nevertheless, she could not stop. She was happy, but at the same time tortured by guilt. Often she thought back to where she had gone wrong. It had been the moment when she ordered her lady-in-waiting and man-at-arms to walk back to Wigley for food. She must have known in her heart that she was going to lie with Ned among the wildflowers beside the stream, and the prospect had been too sweet to resist. She had seen the steep and thorny way to heaven, but had chosen the primrose path of dalliance. She was committing a sin, enjoying it, and repeating it. Every day she vowed to end it, and every time she saw Ned, her resolution evaporated. She was afraid of the consequences, both now and in the afterlife. God would surely punish her. He might afflict her with a terrible disease, or drive her mad, or strike her blind. She sometimes gave herself a headache, thinking about it, and she had additional reasons for fear. Her foreboding about the effects of the papal bull had turned out to be tragically accurate. Puritans could now gleefully point to Catholics as a danger to national security. Intolerance had gained a pretext. Bart now had to pay the large sum of £1 a week, instead of a shilling a week, for not going to church. £1 was the price of a musket, a fancy shirt, or a small pony. It made a dent in Bart's income from rents, which came to about £50 a week. The parish church warden was naturally afraid of the Earl, but summoned up the courage once a week to come to the castle and ask for the money, and Bart had to pay. Much worse was the effect on Rollo. He had lost his business because he would not swear to the 39 articles. He had been forced to sell Priory Gate, and Dan Cobley had exultantly bought it. Lady Jane was now living at Newcastle with Marjorie and Bart. Rollo himself had gone away, and even his mother did not know where. Ned was incandescent with rage. Queen Elizabeth had risked everything for the ideal of religious freedom and had maintained it for a decade, proving that it could be done. But now, he fumed, she was being undermined by the Pope, of all people. Marjorie did not like to hear him criticizing the Pope, even though she secretly agreed with him, so she just tried to avoid the topic. In fact, she avoided all serious thoughts as much as she could, and let her mind dwell on love. When she was not with Ned, she daydreamed about the next time they would meet and what they would do. Now, as her imagination began to depict them together, and she heard, in the ear of fantasy, the intimate words he would murmur to her as he touched her, she felt the familiar sensation in her loins, and her hand drifted to the place between her legs where delight arose. Strangely, her meetings with Ned did not quench this desire. In fact, she did it more now, as if one sin fed the other. Her dog, Mick, lying beside the bed, woke up and growled. "Hush," she murmured, but then he barked. A moment later there was a hammering at the door of the house. The sound itself told Marjorie that trouble had arrived. The knocking was loud, repeated, demanding, authoritative. Few people dared to knock on an earl's door in that aggressive, arrogant manner. She jumped out of bed and ran to the window. Outside, she saw Sheriff Mathewson with a group of 9 or 10 men. She could not guess exactly what the sheriff wanted, but she had no doubt it had to do with religion. She ran from the room, pulling a wrapper over her nightdress. Along the corridor, Bart looked out of his room.
"What is it?"
he said thickly.
"Don't open the door," Marjorie said.
The knocking continued. Marjorie hurried across the landing to Stephen Lincoln's room. She burst in. There was no time for niceties, but he was up and dressed and kneeling at his prie-dieu. "The sheriff is at the door," she said. "Come with me. Bring the sacramentals." Stephen picked up a box containing all they needed for the mass and followed Marjorie out. She saw Bartlett in his nightshirt, followed by a sleepy young nurse.
"Go back to your room, Barty," she said. "I'll come for you when breakfast is ready."
She ran down the stairs, praying that the servants had not already let Matthewson in. She was almost too late. Young Nora Josephs was in the act of unbarring the door, shouting,
all right, I'm coming."
"Wait,"
Marjorie hissed. All the servants were Catholic. They would understand what was happening and keep silent about what they knew. With Stephen close behind, Marjorie ran along the corridor and through a storeroom to a spiral staircase. She went up the stairs and then down a shorter flight into a dead-end passageway that was the bakery of the old castle, now disused. She pulled open the iron door to the massive bread oven where she had kissed Ned all those years ago.
"In here," she said to Stephen. "Hide. Won't they look here? Go all the way to the back and push against the wall. It leads to a secret room. Quickly!"
Stephen climbed inside with his box, and Marjorie shut the door. Breathing hard, she retraced her steps to the front hall. Her mother was there, hair in a nightcap, looking worried. Marjorie pulled the wrapper more closely around her, then nodded to Nora.
"Now you can open up."
Nora opened the door. Marjorie said brightly,
"Good morning, Sheriff. How hard you knocked. Are you in a hurry?"
Matthewson was a big man who had a brusque way with malefactors, but he was uneasy confronting a countess. He tipped up his chin defiantly and said in a loud voice, "Her Majesty the Queen has ordered the arrest of the Catholic priest Stephen Lincoln, suspected of treasonously conspiring with the Queen of the Scots." The charge was ridiculous. Stephen had never met Mary, Queen of Scots, and anyway, he would not have the nerve for a conspiracy. The accusation was malicious, and Marjorie suspected that Dan Cobley was behind it. But she smiled and said, "Then you needn't have woken us up so early. Stephen is not a priest, nor is he here."
"He lives here."
"He was the Earl's clerk, but he has left." Improvising desperately, she added, "I think he may have gone to Canterbury." That was enough detail, she decided. "Anyway, I'm quite sure he has never had anything to do with the Queen of the Scots. I'm sorry you've had a wasted journey, but now that you're here, would you and your men like some breakfast?"
"No, thank you."
He turned to his men. "Search the house." Marjorie heard Bart say,
"Oh, no, you don't."
She turned to see him coming down the stairs. He was wearing his sword as well as his breeches and boots.
"What the devil do you think you're up to, Matthewson?"
"Carrying out orders from the Queen, my lord, and I hope you won't offend Her Majesty by obstructing me."
Marjorie stood between Bart and the sheriff and spoke in a low voice.
"Don't fight him. Don't be executed like your father. Let him search the house. He won't find anything."
"To hell with that!"
The sheriff said,
"You're suspected of harboring a Catholic priest called Stephen Lincoln, who is a traitor. It will be better for you to give him up now."
In a louder voice, Marjorie said to Bart,
"I've already explained that Stephen is not a priest and is no longer here."
Bart looked mystified. He stepped closer to Marjorie and whispered,
"But what about—"
"Trust me," she hissed. Bart shut up. Marjorie raised her voice again. "Perhaps we should allow the sheriff to satisfy himself that we're telling the truth. Then everyone will be content." Enlightenment dawned on Bart. He mouthed,
"In the old oven?"
Marjorie said,
"Yes, that's what I think. Let him search."
Bart looked at Matthewson.
"All right, but I won't forget this, especially your part in it."
"It's not my decision, my lord, as you know."
Bart grunted contemptuously.
"Get going, men," said the sheriff. "Pay special attention to the remains of the old castle. It's sure to be full of hiding places."
He was no fool. Marjorie said to Nora,
"Serve breakfast in the dining room, just for the family, no one else."
There was now no point in pretending to be hospitable. Bart went with ill temper to the dining room, and Lady Jane followed, but Marjorie could not summon enough sang-froid to sit and eat while the men looked for Stephen, so she followed the sheriff around the house. Although his men searched the halls and parlours of the new house, he was more interested in the old castle, and carried a lantern to light dark places. He examined the church first. The tomb of a forgotten ancestor caught his eye, and he grasped the effigy of the knight on top and tried to move it, to test whether it might have been opened. It was firm. The bakery was almost the last place he tried. He opened the iron door and shone his lamp inside, and Marjorie held her breath and pretended insouciance. He leaned forward, head and shoulders in the oven, and waved the lamp around. Was the door at the back as invisible as Marjorie remembered? Mathewson grunted, but she could not interpret the sound. Then he withdrew and slammed the door. Marjorie said gaily, "Did you think we might keep priests in the oven?" Then she hoped he had not noticed the slight tremor in her voice. He looked annoyed and did not trouble to answer her facetious question. They returned to the entrance hall. Mathewson was angry. He suspected he had been hoodwinked, but he could not figure out how. Just as he was about to leave, the front door opened and Sir Ned Willard walked in. She stared at him in horror. He knew the secret of the old bakery. Why was he here? There was a light film of perspiration on his forehead, and he was breathing heavily. Clearly, he had been riding hard. She guessed he had heard somehow about the sheriff's mission, but what was his purpose? No doubt he was worried about Marjorie, but he was a Protestant, too. Would he be tempted to flush out the fugitive priest? His loyalty to Queen Elizabeth was profound, almost like love. Would it be outweighed by his love for Marjorie? He gave Mathewson a hostile glare. "What's going on here?" he said. The sheriff repeated his explanation. "Stephen Lincoln is suspected of treason." "I haven't heard of any such suspicion," Ned said. "As I understand it, Sir Ned, you haven't been in London since before Easter, so perhaps you haven't heard." The sheriff's words were polite, but he said them with a sneer. Ned felt foolish. Marjorie could tell by his face. He prided himself on knowing everything first. He had slipped, and it was undoubtedly because of her. Marjorie said, "Stephen Lincoln is not here. The sheriff has searched my house very thoroughly. If we'd had a Catholic mouse in the pantry, I believe he would have found it." "I'm glad to hear the Queen's orders are being carried out so meticulously," Ned said, apparently changing sides. "Well done, Sheriff." Marjorie felt so tense, she wanted to scream. Was Ned about to say, "But did you find the secret room behind the old oven?" Controlling her voice with an effort, she said, "If that's all, Sheriff?" Mathewson hesitated, but he had nothing left to do. Looking like thunder, he walked away, rudely, without saying farewell. One by one, his men followed him through the door. Bart came out of the dining room. "Have they gone?" he said. Marjorie could not speak. She burst into tears. Bart put his arms around her. "There, there," he said. "You were magnificent." She looked over his shoulder at Ned, who wore the face of a man in torment. Rollo was going to have his revenge. He was weary, dusty, and seething with hatred and resentment when he arrived at the university town of Douai, in the French-speaking southwest of the Netherlands, in July of 1570. It reminded him of Oxford, where he had studied. There were many churches, gracious college buildings, and gardens and orchards where teachers and students could walk and talk. That had been a golden age, he thought bitterly. His father had been alive and prosperous, a strong Catholic had sat on the throne of England, and Rollo had seemed to have an assured future. He had walked a long way across the flat landscape of Flanders, but his feet were not as sore as his heart. The Protestants were never satisfied, he thought furiously. England had a Protestant queen, compliant bishops, an English Bible, and a reformed prayer book. The paintings had been taken down, the statues beheaded, the golden crucifixes melted down, and still it was not enough. They had to take away Rollo's business and his home and drive him out of his own country. One day they would regret it. Speaking a mixture of French and English, he found his way to a brick townhouse, large but not beautiful, in a street of shops and tenements. All his hopes were now invested in this disappointingly ordinary building. If England was to return to the true faith, and if Rollo was to be revenged on his enemies, it would all start here. The door was open. In the hall he met a lively, pink-faced man, about 10 years his junior. Rollo was 35.
"Bonjour, monsieur," he said politely.
"You're English, aren't you?" said the other man.
"Is this the English college?"
"It certainly is."
"Thank God."
Rollo was relieved. It had been a long journey, but he had arrived. Now to find out whether it would live up to his hopes.
"I'm Leonard Price. Call me Lenny. What are you doing here?"
"I lost my livelihood in Kingsbridge because I wouldn't sign the 39 articles."
"Good man.
Thank you.
I'd like to help restore the true faith in England, and I've been told that's your mission here."
"Right again. We train priests, then send them back home, clandestinely, of course, to bring the sacraments to loyal Catholics there."
This was the idea that thrilled Rollo. Now that Queen Elizabeth was beginning to reveal her true tyrannical nature, the church would fight back, and so would Rollo. His life had been ruined, so he had nothing to lose. He should have been a prosperous Kingsbridge alderman, living in the best house in the city, destined eventually to be mayor, like his father. But instead he was an outcast, walking the dusty roads of a foreign land. However, he would turn the tables one day. Lenny lowered his voice.
"If you ask William Allen, that's our founder, he'll say that training priests is our only mission, but some of us have bigger ideas."
"What do you mean?"
"Elizabeth must be deposed, and Mary of Scotland must be queen."
That was what Rollo wanted to hear.
"Are you really planning that?"
Then he hesitated, probably realizing he had been indiscreet.
"Call it a daydream," he said, "but it's one shared by a lot of people."
That was indisputable. Mary's right to the throne was a constant topic of discussion at Catholic dinner tables. Rollo said eagerly,
"Can I see William Allen?"
"Let's go and ask. He's with a very important visitor, but perhaps they'd both like to talk to a potential new recruit. Come with me."
Lenny led Rollo up the stairs to the next floor. Rollo was full of excitement and optimism. Perhaps his life was not over after all. Lenny tapped on a door and opened it onto a spacious, light room lined with books, and two men, deep in conversation. Lenny addressed one of them, a thin-faced man a few years older than Rollo, untidily dressed in a way that reminded Rollo of his Oxford teachers.
"Forgive me for interrupting, sir, but I thought you might like to meet someone newly arrived from England."
Allen turned to his guest and said, in French,
"If you permit."
The second man was younger, but more richly dressed, in a green tunic embroidered with yellow. He was strikingly good-looking, with light brown eyes and thick blonde hair. He shrugged and said,
"As you wish."
Rollo stepped forward and offered his hand.
"My name is Rollo Fitzgerald, from Kingsbridge."
"I'm William Allen."
He shook hands, then indicated his guest with a gesture.
"This is a great friend of the college's, Monsieur Pierre Aumont de Guise, from Paris."
The Frenchman nodded coldly to Rollo and did not offer his hand. Then he said,
"Rollo lost his livelihood because he refused to sign the 39 articles."
"Well done," said Allen,
"and he wants to join us. Sit down, both of you."
Monsieur Aumont de Guise spoke in careful English.
"What education do you have, Rollo?"
"I was at Oxford, then I studied law at Gray's Inn before entering my father's business. I did not take holy orders, but that is what I want to do now."
"Good."
Aumont was thawing a little. Allen said,
"The mission that awaits our students at the end of their training is to risk their lives. You do realize that. If caught, you could be put to death. Please do not join us if you are not prepared for that fate."
Rollo considered his answer.
It would be foolish to treat such a prospect lightly.
He had the satisfaction of seeing Allen nod approvingly. He went on,
"But with God's help, I believe I can face the risk."
Aumont spoke again.
"How do you feel about Protestants? I mean, personally."
"Personally?"
Rollo began to compose another judicious answer.
but his emotions got the better of him. He clenched his fists.
"I hate them,"
he said. He was so moved, he found it hard to get the words out. "I want to wipe them out, destroy them, kill every last one of them. That's how I feel." Ormond almost smiled. "In that case, I think you may have a place with us." Rollo realized he had said the right thing. "Well," said Alan more cautiously, "I hope you will stay with us for a few days at least, so that we can get to know each other better. Then we can talk some more about your future." Ormond said, "Enid's an alias."
"Already?" said Alan. "The fewer people who know his real name, the better."
"I suppose you're right.
Call him Jean Longley."
"John the Englishman, in French."
"All right."
Alan looked at Rollo. "From now on, you are Jean Longley."
"But why?"
said Rollo. Ormond answered him.
"You'll see," he said. "All in good time."
England was in the grip of invasion panic that summer. People saw the papal bull as an incitement to Catholic countries to attack, and any day they expected to see the galleons come over the horizon, teeming with soldiers armed to the teeth, eager to burn and loot and rape. All along the south coast, masons were repairing age-crumbled castle walls. Rusty harbour-mouth cannons were cleaned, oiled, and test-fired. Sturdy farm lads joined the local militia and practiced archery on sunny Sunday afternoons. The Countess of Shiring was in a different kind of fervour. On her way to meet Ned, Marjorie visualised the things they would do together, and she felt the anticipatory moisture inside her. She had once heard someone say that French courtesans washed their private parts every day and perfumed them in case men wanted to kiss them there. She had not believed the story, and Bart had certainly never kissed her there, but Ned did it all the time. So now she washed, like a courtesan. She knew, as she did so, that she was getting ready to commit mortal sin again, and knew too that one day her punishment would come. But those thoughts gave her a pain in her head, and she thrust them away. She went to Kingsbridge and stayed in the house Bart owned on Leper Island. Her pretext was seeing Guillaume Fourneron, a Protestant refugee from France. Fourneron made the finest cambric in the south of England, and Marjorie bought shirts for Bart and for herself, chemises and night dresses. On the second morning, she left the house alone and went to meet Ned at the home of her friend Susanna, now Lady Twyford. She still had the house in Kingsbridge that she had inherited from her father, and she usually stayed there when her husband was travelling. Ned had proposed this rendezvous, and both he and Marjorie felt sure they could trust Susanna to keep their secret. Marjorie had got used to the knowledge that Susanna had once been Ned's lover. Susanna had been bashful when Marjorie revealed that she had guessed the truth.
"You had his heart," Susanna had said. "I just had his body, which fortunately was all I wanted."
Marjorie was living in such a daze of passion that she could hardly think straight about that or anything else. Susanna received her in her parlour, then kissed her on the lips and said,
"Go on up, you lucky girl."
An enclosed staircase led from the parlour up to Susanna's boudoir, and Ned was waiting there. Marjorie threw her arms around him and they kissed urgently, as though starved of love. She broke the kiss to say, "Bed." They went into Susanna's bedroom and pulled off their clothes. Ned's body was slender, his skin white, with thick dark hair on his chest. Marjorie loved just looking at him. But something was wrong. Ned's penis was unresponsive, limp. This happened quite often with Bart when he was drunk, but it was the first time with Ned. Marjorie knelt in front of him and sucked it, as Bart had taught her to do. It sometimes worked with him, but today, with Ned, it made no difference. She stood up, put her hands to his face, and looked into his golden brown eyes. He was embarrassed, she saw. She said,
"What is it, my darling?"
"Something on my mind," he said.
"What?"
"What are we going to do? What is our future?"
"Why, think about it. Let's just love each other."
He shook his head. "I have to make a decision." He put his hand into the coat he had thrown aside and took out a letter.
"From the Queen?"
Marjorie asked. "From Sir William Cecil." Marjorie felt as if the summer day had been blasted by a sudden winter wind.
Bad news?
Ned threw the letter onto the bed. I don't know if it's bad or good. Marjorie stared at it. The letter lay on the counterpane like a dead bird, its folded corners sticking up like stiffening wings, the broken red wax seal like a spatter of blood. Intuition told her that it announced her doom. In a low voice, she said,
"Tell me what it says."
Ned sat up on the bed, crossing his legs. "It's about France," he said. "The Protestants there, they're called Huguenots, seem to be winning the Civil War, with the help of a huge loan from Queen Elizabeth." Marjorie knew this already. She was horrified by the relentless success of heresy, but Ned was pleased about it. Marjorie tried not to think about this or any of the things that divided them. Ned went on, "So, happily, the Catholic king is holding peace talks with the Protestant leader, a man called Gaspard de Coligny." At least Marjorie could share Ned's approval of that. They both wanted Christians to stop killing each other. But how could this blight their love? "Queen Elizabeth is sending a colleague of ours called Sir Francis Walsingham to the conference as a mediator." Marjorie did not understand that. "Do the French really need an Englishman at their peace talks?" "No, that's a cover story." He hesitated. "Cecil doesn't say more in the letter, but I can guess the truth. I'll happily tell you what I think, but you can't tell anyone else."
"All right."
Marjorie took part listlessly in this conversation, which had the effect of postponing the dreaded moment when she would know her fate. "Walsingham is a spy. The Queen wants to know what the King of France intends to do about Scottish Mary. If the Catholics and the Huguenots really do make peace, the King might turn his attention to Scotland, or even England. Elizabeth always wants to know what people might be plotting."
"So the Queen is sending a spy to France?"
"When you put it like that, it's not much of a secret."
"All the same, I won't repeat it. But please, for pity's sake, what has this got to do with you and me?"
"Walsingham needs an assistant. The man must speak fluent French, and Cecil wants me to go. I think Cecil is displeased with me for staying away from London so long."
"So you're leaving me?"
Marjorie said miserably. That was the meaning of the dead bird.
"I don't have to.
We could carry on as we are, loving one another and meeting secretly." Marjorie shook her head. Her mind was clear now, for the first time in weeks, and she could think straight at last.
"We take terrible risks every time. We will be discovered one day. Then Bart will kill you and divorce me and take Bartlett away from me. Then let's just run away. We'll tell people we're married. Mr. and Mrs. Weaver. We can take a ship to Antwerp. I have a distant cousin there, Jan Volman, who will give me work. And Bartlett? We'll take him with us. He's not really Bart's son anyway. We'd be guilty of kidnapping the heir to an earldom. It's probably a capital offence. We could both be executed.
If we rowed to Coombe Harbour, we could be at sea before anyone realises what we've done." Marjorie yearned to say yes. In the past 3 months, she had been happy for the first time since she was 15. The longing to be with Ned possessed her body like a fever. But she knew, even if he did not, that he could never be happy working for his cousin in Antwerp. All his adult life, Ned had been deeply engaged in the government of England, and he liked it more than anything. He adored Queen Elizabeth, he revered William Cecil, and he was fascinated by the challenges facing them. If she took him away from all that, she would ruin him. And she, too, had her work. In recent weeks she had, shamefully, used her sacred mission as a cover for adulterous meetings, but nonetheless, she was dedicated to the task God had assigned her. To give that up would be a transgression as bad as adultery. It was time to end it. She would confess her sin and ask God's mercy. She would rededicate herself to the holy duty of bringing the sacraments to deprived English Catholics. Perhaps in time, she would come to feel forgiven. As she reached her decision, she began to cry.
"Don't," he said. "We can work something out."
She knew they could not. She embraced him and pulled him to her. They lay back on the bed. She whispered,
"Ned, my beloved Ned."
Her tears wetted his face as they kissed. His penis was suddenly erect.
"Once more," she said.
"It's not the last time." he said, as he rolled on top of her. Yes, it is, she thought. But she found she could not speak, and she gave herself up to sorrow and delight. 6 weeks later, Marjorie knew she was pregnant. Chapter 17. Sir Francis Walsingham believed in lists, the way he believed in the Gospels. He made lists of who he had met yesterday and who he was going to see tomorrow, and he and Sir Ned Willard had a list of every suspicious Englishman who came to Paris. In 1572, Walsingham was Queen Elizabeth's ambassador to France, and Ned was his deputy. Ned respected Walsingham, as he had Sir William Cecil, but did not feel the same breathless devotion. Toward Walsingham, Ned was loyal rather than worshipful, admiring rather than awestruck. The two men were different, of course, but also, the Ned who now served as Walsingham's deputy was not the eager youngster who had been Cecil's protégé. Ned had grown up. Ned had undertaken clandestine missions for Elizabeth from the start, but now he and Walsingham were part of the rapidly growing Secret Intelligence Service, set up to protect Elizabeth and her government from violent overthrow. The peace between Catholics and Protestants that had reigned in England for the first decade of Elizabeth's rule had been thrown into jeopardy by the papal bull. There had already been one serious conspiracy against her. The Pope's agent in England, Roberto Ridolfi, had plotted to murder Elizabeth and put Mary Stuart on the throne, and then marry Mary to the Duke of Norfolk. The Secret Service had uncovered the plan, and the Duke's head had been chopped off a few days ago. But no one believed that was the end of the matter. Ned, like all Elizabeth's advisers, feared more conspiracies. Everything he had worked for during the last 14 years was now under threat. The dream of religious freedom could turn overnight into the nightmare of inquisition and torture, and England would again know the revolting smell of men and women being burned alive. Dozens of wealthy Catholics had fled from England, and most of them came to France. Ned and Walsingham believed that the next plot against Elizabeth would be hatched here in Paris. It was their mission to identify the plotters, learn their intentions, and foil their plans. The English embassy was a big house on the left bank, south of the river, in the university district. Walsingham was not a rich man, and England was not a rich country, so they could not afford the more expensive right bank, where the French aristocracy had their palaces. Today Ned and Walsingham were going to attend the royal court in the Louvre Palace. Ned was looking forward to it. The gathering of the most powerful men and women in France was a rich opportunity to pick up information. Courtiers gossiped, and some of them let secrets slip. Ned would chat to everyone and chart the undercurrents. He was just a little nervous, not on his own account, but on that of his master. Walsingham, at 40, was brilliant, but lacked grace. His first appearance before King Charles IX had been embarrassing. A stiff-necked Puritan, Walsingham had dressed all in black. It was his normal style, but in the gaudy French court it was seen as a Protestant reproach. On that first occasion, Ned had recognized Pierre Aumont de Guise, whom he had met at Saint-Dizier with Mary Stuart. That had been 11 years ago, but Ned remembered Aumont vividly. Although the man had been good-looking and well-dressed, there was something creepy about him. King Charles had pointedly asked Walsingham whether it was really necessary for Elizabeth to imprison Mary Stuart, the former Queen of France, the deposed Queen of Scots, and Charles's sister-in-law. Walsingham should have known the Book of Proverbs well enough to remember, "A soft answer turneth away wrath." However, he had responded with righteous indignation, always a weakness in Puritans, and the king had become frosty. Since then, Ned had made a special effort to be more easygoing and amiable than his unbending boss. He had adopted a style of dress appropriate to a minor diplomat without rigid religious convictions. Today, he put on a pastel blue doublet, slashed to show a fawn lining, an unostentatious outfit by Paris standards, but, he hoped, stylish enough to distract from the appearance of Walsingham, who clung stubbornly to his black. From his attic window, Ned could see across the Seine River to the towers of the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Beside his smoky mirror stood a little portrait Marjorie had given him. It was somewhat idealized, with impossibly white skin and rosy cheeks, but the artist had captured her tumbling curls and the mischievous grin he had loved so much. He still loved her. 2 years ago he had been forced to accept that she would never leave her husband, and without hope his passion had burned low. But the fire had not gone out, and perhaps it never would. He had no news from Kingsbridge. He had not heard from Barney, who was presumably still at sea. He and Marjorie had agreed not to torture themselves by writing to one another. The last thing Ned had done, before leaving England, was to quash the arrest warrant for Stephen Lincoln, which had been issued on the basis of evidence invented by Dan Cobley. If Marjorie felt it her sacred duty to bring consolation to bereft Catholics, Ned was not going to let Dan Cobley stop her. Adjusting his lace collar in front of the mirror, he smiled as he remembered the play he had seen last night, called The Rivals. Highly original, it was a comedy about ordinary people who spoke naturally rather than in verse, and featured two young men, both of whom wanted to abduct the same girl, who turned out, in a surprise ending, to be the sister of one of them. The whole thing took place in one location, a short stretch of street, in a period of less than 24 hours. Ned had not before seen anything so clever in London or Paris. Ned was just about ready to leave when a servant came in.
"A woman has called, selling paper and ink cheaper than anywhere in Paris, she claims," the man said in French. "Do you care to see her?"
Ned used huge quantities of expensive paper and ink, drafting and encoding Walsingham's confidential letters to the Queen and Cecil. And the Queen was as parsimonious with her spies as she was with everyone, so he was always looking for lower prices. "What is Sir Francis doing right now?"
"Reading his Bible."
"Then I have time. Send her up." A minute later, a woman of about 30 appeared. Ned looked at her with interest. She was attractive rather than beautiful, modestly dressed, with a determined look, softened by blue eyes. She introduced herself as Thérèse Saint-Quentin. She took samples of paper and ink out of a leather satchel and invited Ned to try them. He sat at his writing table. Both paper and ink seemed good.
"Where do you get your supplies?"
he asked.
"The paper is made just outside Paris, in the suburb of Saint-Marcel," she said. "I also have beautiful Italian paper from Fabriano, in Italy, for your love letters."
It was a flirty thing to say, but she was not very coquettish, and he guessed it was part of her sales pitch. "And the ink?"
"I make it myself. That's why it's so cheap, though it's very good."
He compared her prices with what he usually paid, and found that she was indeed cheap, so he gave her an order.
"I'll bring everything today," she said.
Then she lowered her voice.
"Do you have the Bible in French?"
Ned was astonished. Could this respectable-looking young woman be involved in illicit literature?
"It's against the law."
She responded calmly, "But breaking the law no longer carries the death penalty, according to the Peace of Saint-Germain." She was talking about the agreement that had resulted from the peace conference Ned and Walsingham had been sent to in Saint-Germain. So Ned knew the details well. The treaty gave the Huguenots limited freedom of worship. For Ned, a Catholic country that tolerated Protestants was as good as a Protestant country that tolerated Catholics. It was the freedom that counted. However, freedom was fragile. France had had peace treaties before, all of them short-lived. The famously inflammatory Paris preachers ranted against every attempt at conciliation. This one was supposed to be sealed by a marriage. The king's rackety sister, Princess Margot, was engaged to the easygoing Henri of Bourbon, Protestant king of Navarre. But 18 months later, the wedding still had not taken place. Ned said the peace treaty could be abandoned, and any day there could be a surprise crackdown on people like you.
"It probably wouldn't be a surprise."
Ned was about to ask why not, but she did not give him the chance. She went on,
"And I think I can trust you. You're Elizabeth's envoy, so you must be Protestant."
"Why do you ask?" Ned said cautiously.
"If you want a French Bible, I can get you one."
Ned was amazed by her nerve, and as it happened, he did want a French Bible. He spoke the language well enough to pass as a native, but sometimes, in conversation, he did not catch the biblical quotations and allusions that Protestants used all the time, and he had often thought he should read the better-known chapters to familiarize himself with the translation. As a foreign diplomat, he would not get into much trouble for owning the book, in the unlikely event that he was found out.
"How much?" he said. "I have 2 editions, both printed in Geneva. A standard one that is a bargain at 2 livres, and a beautifully bound volume in 2 colors of ink with illustrations for 7 livres. I can bring them both to show you."
"All right.
I see you're going out, to the Louvre, I suppose, in that beautiful coat."
"Yes."
"Will you be back for your dinner?"
"Probably." Ned felt bemused. She had taken control of the conversation. All he did was agree to what she proposed. She was forceful, but so frank and engaging that he could not be offended.
"I'll bring your stationery then, and 2 Bibles, so that you can choose the one you prefer."
Ned did not think he had actually committed himself to buying one, but he let that pass. "I look forward to seeing them.
I'll be back this afternoon."
Her coolness was impressive. "You're very brave," Ned commented.
"The Lord gives me strength."
No doubt he did, Ned thought, but she must have had plenty to start with. "Tell me something," he said, taking the conversational initiative at last. "How did you come to be a dealer in contraband books?"
"My father was a printer. He was burned as a heretic in 1559, and all his possessions were forfeit, so my mother and I were destitute. All we had was a few Bibles he had printed."
"So you've been doing this for 13 years?
"Almost."
Her courage took Ned's breath away. "During most of that period, you could have been executed, like your father."
"Yes."
"But surely you could live innocently, selling just paper and ink."
"We could. But we believe in people's right to read God's word for themselves and make up their own minds about what is the true gospel."
"Ned believed in that too. And you're willing to risk your life for that principle?" He did not mention that if caught, she would undoubtedly have been tortured before being executed.
"Yes," she said.
Ned stared at her, fascinated. She looked back at him boldly for a few moments. Then she said,
"Until this afternoon, then. Goodbye."
When she had gone, Ned went to the window and looked out across the busy fruit and vegetable market of the Place Maubert. She was not as afraid as she might have been of a crackdown on Protestants.
"It probably wouldn't be a surprise," she had said.
He wondered what means she had of finding out in advance about the intentions of the ultra-Catholics. A few moments later, she emerged from the door below and walked away, a small, erect figure with a brisk, unwavering step, willing to die for the ideal of tolerance that Ned shared. "What a woman," he thought. "What a hero." He watched her out of sight. Pierre Ormond de Guise trimmed his fair beard in preparation for going to court at the Louvre Palace. He always shaped his beard into a sharp point to look more like his young master and distant relative Henri, the 21-year-old Duke of Guise. He studied his face. He had developed a dry skin condition that gave him red flaking patches at the corners of his eyes and mouth and on his scalp. They had also appeared on the backs of his knees and the insides of his elbows, where they itched maddeningly. The Guise family doctor had diagnosed an excess of heat and prescribed an ointment that seemed to make the symptoms worse. His 12-year-old stepson, Alain, came into the room. He was a wretched child, undersized and timid, more like a girl. Pierre had sent him to the dairy on the corner to buy milk and cheese, and now he was carrying a jug and a goblet. Pierre said, "Where's the cheese?" The boy hesitated, then said,
"They haven't got any today."
Pierre looked at his face.
"Liar," he said, "you forgot."
Alain was terrified.
"No, I didn't, honestly."
He started to cry. The scrawny maid, Nath, came in.
"What's the matter, Alain?"
she said. Pierre said, "He lied to me and now he's afraid of a thrashing. What do you want?"
"There's a priest to see you, Jean Longley."
That was the pseudonym Pierre had given Rollo Fitzgerald, the most promising of the exiles studying at the English college.
"Send him up here.
Take this snivelling child away, and get some cheese for my breakfast. Pierre had met Rollo twice since that initial encounter, and had been impressed by him each time. The man was intelligent and dedicated, and in his eyes there was the burning light of a holy mission. He hated Protestants passionately, no doubt because his family had been ruined financially by the Puritans in Kingsbridge, the city from which he came. Pierre had high hopes for Rollo. A moment later, Rollo appeared, wearing a floor-length cassock and a wooden cross on a chain. They shook hands and Pierre closed the door. Rollo said, "Is that young lady your wife?"
"Certainly not,"
said Pierre. "Madame Aumont de Guise was a lady-in-waiting to Véronique de Guise." That was not true. Odette had been a servant, not a lady-in-waiting. But Pierre did not like people to know it.
"She's out."
Odette had gone to the fish market. "The woman who admitted you is just a maid." Rollo was embarrassed. "I do beg your pardon."
"Not at all. Welcome to our humble dwelling. I spend most of my time at the Guise family palace in the Vieille Rue de Temple. But if you and I had met there, we would have been seen by 20 people. This place has one great advantage. It is so insignificant that no one would bother to spy on it."
In fact, Pierre was desperate to move out of this hovel, but had not yet managed to persuade the young Duke to give him a room at the palace. He was now chief among the Guise family's councillors, but as always, they were slow to grant Pierre the status his work merited.
"How are things in Douai?"
"Excellent. Since the Pope excommunicated Elizabeth, another 15 good Catholic young Englishmen have joined us. In fact, William Allen sent me here to tell you that we're almost ready to send a group of them back to England."
"And how will that be organized?"
"Father Allen has asked me to take charge of the operation." Pierre thought that was a good decision. Rollo clearly had the ability to be more than just a clandestine priest.
"What's your plan?"
"We will land them on a remote beach at dusk. Then they'll travel through the night to my sister's castle. She is the Countess of Sharing. She has been organizing secret Catholic services for years, and she already has a network of undercover priests. From there they will spread out all over England."
"How reliable is your sister?"
"Totally, with anything that doesn't involve bloodshed. There she draws a line, I'm afraid. She has never understood that violence is sometimes necessary in the service of the church."
"She's a woman."
Pierre was pleased that Rollo evidently did understand the need for violence.
"And in Paris," Rollo said, "we in Douai have been worried by the news from here. The Peace of Saint-Germain was a major defeat for us. There's no denying that. The policy of Pope Pius V is quite clearly to exterminate all Protestants, but King Charles IX has rejected this in favor of peaceful coexistence."
Rollo nodded. To some extent, the king was forced into that by military defeat.
"Yes. It's most unfortunate that Coligny has proved to be such a disciplined and talented general of the Huguenot armies. And the Queen Mother, Katharina, is another force for tolerance of vile heresy."
Sometimes Pierre felt as if every hand was against him.
"But we have seen edicts of tolerance before, and they have never lasted," he added optimistically.
"Will Princess Margot marry Henri of Bourbon?" Rollo asked all the right questions. Henri was the son of the late Antoine of Bourbon, and as King of Navarre, he was the highest-ranking member of the pro-tolerance Bourbon-Montmorency alliance. If he married into the royal Valois family, he might be able to preserve the Peace of Saint-Germain, and the combined families of Bourbon, Montmorency, and Valois would be enough to crush the Guises.
"We've done everything we can to delay the marriage," Pierre said, "but Coligny lurks in the background. A constant threat. It's a pity someone doesn't stick a knife in his heart."
"Many people would like to, believe me," said Pierre. That included Pierre himself. "But Coligny is not stupid, and doesn't give them much chance. He rarely comes to Paris." He heard the bell of St. Etienne's church strike 10. "I have to attend court," he said. "Where are you staying?" Rollo looked around. Clearly he had been expecting to lodge at Pierre's house, but now realized the place was too small.
"I don't know. The Count of Beaulieu always welcomes English Catholics. You may meet people who could be useful to you at his house,
But watch out for English Protestants, too.
Are there many in Paris?
Some, mainly at the embassy. Sir Francis Walsingham is the ambassador. He's a curmudgeon, but as sharp as a nail.
And a blaspheming Puritan.
I'm keeping an eye on him. But his deputy is more dangerous, because he has charm, as well as brains. He's called Sir Ned Willard.
Rollo reacted.
Really?
Ned Willard is deputy ambassador. You obviously know the men. He comes from Kingsbridge. I didn't realize he had become so important.
Oh, yes.
Pierre recalled the young man who had pretended to be a Scottish Protestant at Saint-Dizier. Later, Pierre had read, in a smuggled letter from Alison Mackay, how Willard had gone to Carlisle Castle to tell Mary Stuart that she was a prisoner, and now the man had shown up in Paris.
Ned Willard is not to be underestimated. I used to flog him at school.
Did you? I wish I'd beaten him to death.
Pierre stood up. The Count of Beaulieu lives in the Rue Saint-Denis. I'll point you in the right direction.
He led Rollo downstairs and out into the street.
Come and see me again before you leave Paris. I may have letters for William Allen.
He gave Rollo directions to the Beaulieu Palace, and the two men shook hands. As Rollo walked away, Pierre noticed the back of a woman going in the same direction. She seemed familiar, but she turned the corner and was out of sight before he could place her. However, she had not been richly dressed, so could not have been anyone important, and he went back inside and forgot about her. He found Alain in the kitchen. Using a kinder tone of voice than usual, he said,
"Alain, I have something sad to tell you. There has been an accident. Your mother has been kicked by a horse. I'm afraid she is dead."
Alain stared at him, wide-eyed, for a long moment. Then his face crumpled in anguish, and he began to wail.
"Mammy," he cried, "mammy, mammy."
"There's no point in calling her," Pierre said, reverting to the irritated tone he normally used with the boy. "She can't hear you. She's dead. She's gone, and we'll never see her again."
Alain screamed in grief. Pierre's deception was so effective that he almost regretted it. A minute later, Odette came rushing in with her fish basket.
"What is it? What is it, Alain?"
she cried. The boy opened his eyes, saw his mother, and threw his arms around her.
"He said you were dead," he wailed.
"You cruel swine," Odette said to Pierre. "Why did you do that?"
"To teach the boy a lesson," Pierre said, pleased with himself. "He lied to me, so I lied to him. He won't do it again in a hurry."
The Louvre was a square medieval fort with round, cone-roofed corner towers. Walsingham and Ned crossed a drawbridge over a moat to enter the courtyard. Ned was alert, excited, eager. The power was here. In this building were the men who commanded armies and started wars, men who could raise their friends to high rank and destroy their enemies, men who decided who should live and who should die. And Ned was going to talk to them. The late King Henri II had demolished the west wall of the square and replaced it with a modern palace in the Italian style, with fluted pilasters, immensely tall windows, and a riot of sculpture. There was nothing like it in London, Ned reflected. More recently, Henri's son Charles IX had extended the new building, making an L shape. As always, the court gathered in a series of interconnecting spaces that delineated a hierarchy. Grooms, maids, and bodyguards remained outside in the courtyard, whatever the weather. Ned and Walsingham entered the central door into the ballroom, which occupied the entire ground floor of the West Wing. In this room were superior attendants, such as ladies-in-waiting. Passing through, on his way to the next level, Ned was surprised to notice a stunning woman staring at him, her expression an odd mixture of shock, hope, and puzzlement. He looked hard at her. About his age, she was a classic Mediterranean beauty, with a mass of dark hair, heavily marked eyebrows, and sensual lips. Wearing bright red and black, she was easily the most flamboyantly dressed woman in the room, though her clothes were not the most expensive on display. There was something about her that made Ned think she was not merely a lady-in-waiting. She spoke with an accent that was neither French nor English.
"No,
"You're definitely not Barney," she said. It was a confused statement, but Ned understood. "My brother's name is Barney, but he's taller than I am, and handsomer."
"You must be Ned."
He placed her accent as Spanish.
"I am, senorita," he said, and bowed. "Barney mentioned you often. He was very fond of his little brother."
Walsingham interrupted impatiently to say, "I'll go on. Don't be long." The woman said to Ned, "I am Geronimo Ruiz." The name rang a bell. "Did you know Barney in Seville?"
"Know him. I wanted to marry him, but it was not in the stars."
"And now you're in Paris."
"I am the niece of Cardinal Romero, who is here on a diplomatic mission for King Felipe of Spain."
Ned would have heard about such a mission if it were official, so this must have been something informal. Fishing for information, he said, "I assume King Felipe doesn't want Princess Margot to marry a Huguenot." In the chess game of international diplomacy, the King of Spain supported the Catholics in France, just as the Queen of England helped the Protestants.
"As a mere woman, I take no interest in such matters."
Ned smiled, answered like a skilled diplomat. She kept up the pretense.
"My role is to act as hostess at my uncle's table. The cardinal has no wife, obviously."
She gave him a provocative look. "Unlike your English priests, who are allowed to do anything." She was alluring, Ned found.
"Why didn't you marry my brother?"
A hard look came over her face.
"My father died while being interviewed by the Inquisition. My family lost everything. Archdeacon Romero, as he then was, invited me to join his household. He saved me. But of course I could not think of marrying."
Ned understood. She was not Romero's niece. She was his mistress. The priest had taken advantage of her at a moment when her world seemed to have collapsed. He looked into her eyes and saw pain there.
"You've been treated cruelly," he said. "I made my own decisions."
Ned wondered whether her experiences had turned her against the Catholic Church, and if that were the case, whether she might take her revenge by helping the Protestant cause. But he hesitated to ask her outright.
"I'd like to talk to you again," he said.
She gave him an appraising look, and he had the unnerving feeling that she knew what was in his mind.
"All right," she said.
Ned bowed and left her. He passed under the musicians' gallery, held up by four caryatids, and went up the stairs. What a beautiful woman, he thought, though she was more Barney's type than Ned's.
What is my type?
He asked himself. Someone like Marjorie, of course. He walked through the guardroom of the Swiss mercenaries who formed the king's personal protection squad, then entered a large, light room called the wardrobe. Here waited people who might or might not be admitted to the royal presence, minor nobility and petitioners. Walsingham said grumpily, "You took your time with that Spanish tart."
"It was worth it, though," Ned replied.
"Really?" Walsingham was skeptical. "She's the mistress of Cardinal Romero. I think I may be able to recruit her as an informant." Walsingham changed his tone.
"Good. I'd like to know what that slimy Spanish priest is up to."
His eye lighted on the Marquis of Lagny, an amiable fat man who covered his bald head with a jeweled cap. Lagny was a Protestant and close to Gaspard de Coligny. Aristocratic Huguenots had to be tolerated at court, at least until they did something overtly defiant of the king.
"Come with me," Walsingham said to Ned, and they crossed the room.
Walsingham greeted the Marquis in fluent, precise French. He had lived in exile for most of the reign of Elizabeth's Catholic elder sister, Queen Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, and he spoke several languages. He asked Lagny about the topic on everyone's mind, the Spanish Netherlands. King Felipe's ruthlessly effective general, the Duke of Alba, was mercilessly crushing the Dutch Protestant rebels. A French Protestant army led by Jean d'Angest, Lord of Genlis, was on its way to help the rebels. Lagny said, "Coligny has ordered Angest to join forces with William of Orange." The Prince of Orange was the leader of the Dutch. "Orange has asked Queen Elizabeth for a loan of £30,000,
Lonnie went on. Will she oblige him, Sir Francis?
Perhaps, said Walsingham.
Ned thought the likelihood was small. Elizabeth probably did not have £30,000 to spare, and if she did, she could think of better uses for it. Ned was drawn away from the conversation by a richly dressed woman of middle age who spoke to him in English.
Sir Ned, she said, what a fine doublet.
Ned bowed to Marianne, Countess of Beaulieu, an English Catholic married to a French nobleman. She was with her daughter, a plump 18-year-old with a vivacious manner. Her name was Aphrodite. Her father was a scholar of Greek. The Countess had a soft spot for Ned and encouraged him to talk to Aphrodite. The Countess would never let her daughter marry a Protestant, of course, but no doubt she thought Ned might convert. Ned liked Aphrodite well enough, but had no romantic interest in her. She was a jolly, carefree girl with no serious interests, and she quickly bored him. Nevertheless, Ned flirted with both mother and daughter because he longed to get inside the Beaulieu mansion in the Rue Saint-Denis, which was a refuge for exiled English Catholics and might well be where the next plot against Queen Elizabeth was being hatched. But so far, he had not been invited. Now he talked to the Beaulieus about the worst-kept secret in Paris, the affair between Princess Margot and Duke Henri of Guise. The Countess said darkly, Duke Henri is not the first man to have paid court to the princess. Young Aphrodite was shocked and excited by the suggestion that a princess might be promiscuous.
Mother, she said, you ought not to repeat such slanders. Margot is engaged to marry Henri of Bourbon.
Ned murmured, perhaps she just got the two Henris mixed up. The Countess giggled. They have too many Henris in this country. Ned did not even mention the more shocking rumour that Margot was simultaneously having an incestuous relationship with her 17-year-old brother, Hercule Francis. The two women were distracted by the approach of Bernard Huss, a bright young courtier who knew how to make himself useful to the king. Aphrodite greeted him with a pleased smile, and Ned thought he might suit her very well. Ned turned away and caught the eye of the Marchioness of Nîmes, a Protestant aristocrat. About Ned's age and voluptuous, Louise de Nîmes was the second wife of the much older Marquis. Her father, like Ned's, had been a wealthy merchant. She immediately gave Ned the latest gossip. The king found out about Margot and Henri de Guise.
Really? What did he do?
He dragged her out of her bed and had her flogged.
My goodness.
She's 18, isn't she?
It's a bit old for flogging.
A king can do what he likes.
Louise looked over Ned's shoulder and her face changed. Her smile vanished and she looked as if she had seen a dead rat. The alteration was so striking that Ned turned to find out what had caused it and saw Pierre Aumond.
I guess you don't like Monsieur Aumond de Guise, he said.
He's a snake, and he's not a Guise. I'm from the same part of the world, and I know his background.
Oh, do tell me.
His father is the illegitimate son of one of the Guise men. The family sent the bastard to school and made him the parish priest of Tonnons-les-Joinville.
If he's a priest, how can he be Pierre's father?
Pierre's mother is the priest's housekeeper.
So Pierre is the illegitimate son of an illegitimate son of a Guise.
And then to cap it all, they made Pierre marry a servant who had been impregnated by another Randy Guise.
Fascinating.
Ned turned again and studied Pierre for a moment. He was richly dressed, in a lavender doublet, pinked to show a purple lining. It doesn't seem to have held him back.
He's a horrible man. He was rude to me once, so I told him off, and he's hated me ever since.
Pierre was talking to a tough-looking man who seemed not quite sufficiently well-dressed to be here, Ned saw. He said, I've always found Pierre a bit sinister.
A bit?
Walsingham beckoned, and Ned left Louise and joined him as he moved to the doorway that led to the last and most important room, the king's private chamber. Pierre watched Walsingham pass into the private chamber with his sidekick, Ned Willard. He felt a wave of revulsion, almost like nausea. Those two were the enemies of everything that kept the Guise family powerful and wealthy. They were not noble. They came from a poor, backward country, and they were heretics. But all the same, he feared and loathed them. He was standing with his chief spy, Georges Biron, Lord of Montagny, a little village in Poitiers. Biron was a minor peer, with almost no income. His only asset was his ability to move easily in noble society. Under Pierre's tutelage, he had become sly and ruthless. Biron said, "I've had Walsingham under surveillance for a month, but he isn't involved in anything we can use against him. He has no lovers, male or female. He doesn't gamble or drink, and he makes no attempts to bribe the king's servants, or indeed anyone else. He's either innocent or very discreet."
"I'm guessing discreet."
Biron shrugged. Pierre's instinct told him the two English Protestants had to be up to something. He made a decision.
"Switch the surveillance to the deputy."
"Willard." The surname was difficult to pronounce in French. "Same procedure. 24 hours. Find out what his weaknesses are."
"Very good, sir."
Pierre left him and followed Walsingham into the audience chamber. He was proud to be one of the privileged. On the other hand, he remembered, with bitter nostalgia, the days when he and the Guise brothers had actually lived in the palace with the royal family.
"We will return," he vowed.
He crossed the room and bowed to Henri, the young Duke of Guise. Henri had been 12 when Pierre brought him the news of the assassination of his father and assured him that the man responsible for the murder was Gaspard de Coligny. Now Henri was 21, but he had not forgotten his oath of revenge. Pierre had made sure of that. Duke Henri was very like his late father, tall, fair, handsome, and aggressive. At the age of 15, he had gone to Hungary to fight against the Turks. All he lacked was the disfigurement that had given Duke François the nickname Scarface. Duke Henri had been taught that his destiny was to uphold the Catholic Church and the Guise family, and he had never questioned that. His affair with Princess Margot was a sure sign of courage, one court wit had said, for Margot was a handful. Pierre imagined they must make a tempestuous couple. A door opened, a trumpet sounded, everyone fell silent, and King Charles came in. He had been 10 years old when he became king, and at that time all the decisions had been made by other people, mainly his mother, Queen Caterina. He was 21 now, and could give his own orders, but he was in poor health. They said he had a weak chest, and he continued to be easily led, sometimes by Caterina, sometimes by others. Unfortunately, not by the Guise family at present. He began by dealing with courtesies and routine business, occasionally giving a hoarse, unwholesome cough, sitting on a carved and painted chair, while everyone else in the room remained standing. But Pierre sensed he had an announcement to make, and it was not long coming.
"The marriage between our sister Margot and Henri de Bourbon, the King of Navarre, was agreed in August the year before last," he said.
Pierre felt Henri de Guise tense up beside him. This was not just because he was Margot's lover. The Bourbons were bitter enemies of the Guises. The two families had warred for supremacy under the French king since before either of these two Henris was born. King Charles went on,
"The marriage will reinforce the religious reconciliation of our kingdom."
That was what the Guises feared. Pierre sensed the peacemaking mind of Queen Caterina behind the formal words of the king.
"So I have decided that the wedding will take place on the 18th of August next."
There was a buzz around the room. This was big news. Many had hoped or feared that the wedding would never happen. Now a date had been set. This was a triumph for the Bourbons and a blow to the Guises. Henri was furious.
"A blaspheming Bourbon marrying into the royal family of France," he said with disgust.
Pierre was downcast. A threat to the Guise family was a threat to him. He could lose everything he had won.
"When your Scottish cousin Mary Stuart married Francis, it made us the top family,"
he said gloomily to Duke Henri.
"Now the Bourbons will be top family."
Henri's political calculation was correct, but his rage was undoubtedly fueled by sexual jealousy. Margot was probably an exciting lover. She had that wild look, and now she had been taken from Henri by a Bourbon. Pierre was able to be calmer and think more clearly, and he saw something that had not occurred to young Henri. "The marriage still may never happen," he said. Henri had his father's soldierly impatience with double talk.
"What the devil do you mean?
The wedding will be the biggest event in the story of French Protestantism. It will be the triumph of the Huguenots."
"How can that be good news?"
"They will come to Paris from all over the country. Those who are invited to the wedding, and thousands more who will want just to watch the procession and rejoice.
It will be a foul spectacle. I can just see them strutting through the streets, flaunting their black clothes."
Pierre lowered his voice.
"And then we'll see trouble."
Henri's face showed that he was beginning to understand.
"You think there may be violence between triumphant Protestant visitors and the resentful Catholic citizens of Paris?"
"Yes," said Pierre,
"and that will be our chance."
On her way to the warehouse, Sylvie stopped at the tavern of Saint-Étienne and ordered a plate of smoked eel for her midday meal. She also bought a tankard of weak beer and tipped the potboy to take it around the corner and deliver it to the back door of Pierre Aumont's house. This was the signal for Pierre's maid, Nath, to come to the tavern, if she could, and a few minutes later she appeared. Now in her mid-twenties, Nath was as scrawny as ever, but she looked out at the world through eyes that were no longer frightened. She was a stalwart of the Protestant congregation in the room over the stables, and having a group of friends had given her a modest degree of confidence. Sylvie's friendship had helped, too. Sylvie got straight down to business.
"This morning, I saw Pierre with a priest I didn't recognize," she said. "I happened to be passing the door when they came out."
Something about the man had struck her vividly. His features were unremarkable. He had receding dark hair and a reddish-brown beard, but there was an intensity in his expression that made her think he was a dangerous zealot.
"Yes, I was going to tell you about him,"
Nat said.
"He's English."
"Oh, interesting.
Did you get his name?" "Jean Langlais."
"Sounds like a false name for an Englishman."
"He's never been to the house before, but Pierre seemed to know him, so they must have met somewhere else."
"Did you hear what they talked about?"
Nat shook her head.
"Pierre closed the door. Pity."
Nat looked anxious.
"Did Pierre see you when you walked by?"
She was right to be concerned, Sylvie thought. They did not want Pierre to suspect how closely he was being watched by the Protestants.
"I don't think he did. I certainly didn't meet his eye. I'm not sure he'd recognize me from behind." "He can't have forgotten you."
"Hardly. He did marry me."
Sylvie grimaced at the loathsome memory.
"On the other hand, he's never mentioned you.
He thinks I'm not important anymore, which suits me fine."
Sylvie finished her meal and they left the tavern separately. Sylvie walked north, heading for the Rue du Mur. Ned Willard would be interested to hear about the visiting English priest, she guessed. She had liked Ned. So many men regarded a woman selling something as a fair target for sexual banter, or worse, as if she would suck a man off just to get him to buy a jar of ink. But Ned had talked to her with interest and respect. He was a man of some power and importance, but he showed no arrogance. In fact, he had a rather modest charm. All the same, she suspected he was no softy. Hanging alongside his coat, she had seen a sword and a long Spanish dagger that looked as if they were not merely for decoration. No one else was in sight in the Rue du Mur when Sylvie took the key from behind the loose brick and let herself into the windowless old stable that had served her for so many years as a hiding place for illegal books. Her stocks were running low again. She would have to order more from Guillaume in Geneva. Her correspondence with Guillaume was handled by a Protestant banker in Rouen, who had a cousin in Geneva. The banker was able to receive money from Sylvie and have his cousin pay Guillaume. Sylvie still had to sail down the Seine to Rouen to do business, but it was a lot easier than going to Geneva. She would collect her shipment personally and bring it upriver to Paris. With the help of the cargo broker, Luc Mauriac, she paid all the bribes necessary to make sure that her crates of stationery were not inspected by customs. It was risky, like any criminal activity, but so far she had survived. She found two Bibles and packed them into her satchel, then walked to the shop in the Rue de la Serpente, a narrow street in the university district. She went in by the back door and called to her mother.
"It's only me. I'm with a customer."
Sylvie picked up the paper and ink ordered by Ned and stacked the parcels on a small handcart. She thought of telling her mother about the large order she had won from the charming Englishman and found herself reluctant to do so. She felt a little foolish for being so taken with him after one short meeting. Isabel was a strong character with decided opinions, and Sylvie always had to be ready to either agree or give good reasons for disagreeing. They had no secrets from one another. In the evening, each would tell the other everything that had happened during the day. But by then, Sylvie would have seen Ned again. She might not like him the second time.
"I have a delivery to make,"
she called out, and she left the shop.